This is a big year. The Ohio Lottery's golden anniversary. 50 years of excitement, of growing jackpots and crossed fingers. 50 years of funding for schools, of changed lives and brightened days. 50 years of fun, and that is worth celebrating. So watch for can't-miss promotions, huge events, and new games that will make the Ohio Lottery's 50th year its biggest one yet. Learn more at funturns50.com.
Want to connect with a family member who doesn't speak your language? Then check out the language learning program Rosetta Stone on desktop or as an app. Rosetta Stone is designed to immerse you in the language you're learning through an intuitive process. Plus, the True Accent feature even gives you feedback on your pronunciation. And with a lifetime membership, you have access to all 25 offered languages. Get started today. Visit rosettastone.com/pod50 to get 50% off your lifetime membership now. That's rosettastone.com/pod50 for 50% off.
You have to be optimistic. This is to say, I'm not saying we ignore what's going on. It's just that we have to be optimistic in order to solve these problems. If you go into any sort of problem with the predisposition that it cannot be solved, that you'll never get there, then you won't solve it. This on? Hello? Hello?
We're all science people.
Science. Exactly.
We know it's a good idea because it's lasted.
There's chemistry in here. There's biology in here.
It's in whiskey. It's in ice cream. It's in who you fall in love with.
Rules. And ethics. And everything else.
We can make the world better for everybody.
Starting now.
Welcome to Science Rules. I'm your host, Bill Nye. This is the show where science rules. It's a call-in show. So if you want to be on the show, and of course I hope you do, please go to askbillnye.com and type on in and tell us what's on your mind. And I say us, you know why I say us? Because I am joined once again by science writer, editor, and dear friend, Corey S. Powell. Greetings, Corey.
Salutations to you, Bill.
Yes, today we are talking about how to talk about climate change with someone who is very well-versed in this topic. He is a climatologist, a geophysicist, and the director of the Earth System Science Center at Pennsylvania State University. Welcome to Science Rules, Dr. Michael Mann.
Thanks so much, Bill. Thanks, guys. It's great to be with you.
Now, Mike, you started out as, if I may, a scientist, but how much of your time is devoted these days to communicating the dangers of climate change versus researching climate change? I mean, is this consuming you? Is it a burden?
It's a burden. I mean, I spend most of my time talking to guys like you, and so it's really delightful to have the opportunity to talk with you guys, to be part of this exciting new podcast. And indeed, it is what I spend a lot of my time doing these days. It's not what I signed up for when I double majored in applied math and physics at UC Berkeley back in the 1980s.
Applied math and physics, you were studying like Bose-Einstein condensates or something like that?
I was doing theoretical condensed matter physics.
What is that?
More commonly refer to it, or at least a substantial part of that field, as solid-state physics. But condensed matter physics also includes the behavior of liquids as well as solids. And so it's really about the theory of our matter, in a sense, everyday matter, liquids, solids, what causes them to transition, phase transitions, like water becoming ice is an example of a phase transition. And the physics of those phase transitions can be very interesting and very challenging to model.
You were still doing that into graduate school before you switched.
Going from that
to climate, I mean, that seems like a fairly big life change. What happened?
I won't discuss the details of it. No, I'm just kidding. I did have a bit of a crisis of scientific identity. I was about to spend the rest of my life working on some fairly
arcane,
weird would be the right word. Arcane sort of problems in solid state physics. And it just wasn't exciting me. And so I had this sort of crisis of scientific identity. Is this the way I want to be spending the rest of my life? And decided that I sort of needed to consider my options, look at what the other opportunities are out there for somebody like myself who had, you know, developed math and physics knowledge and skills. Was there a problem that really excited me where I could use the math and the physics that I had learned in theoretical physics?
You met an academic colleague or professor who wanted you to work on this or something?
Well, it was even more circuitous. In fact, I sometimes use the example of the self-avoiding random walk. Random walk is a statistical model that you actually find in condensed matter physics that describes sort of the random behavior of matter.
Like a drunk person staggering around
a lamp pole. Exactly. It's the drunk person staggering around, and there's a version of it called the self-avoiding random walk, again, a statistical model in physics, where the drunk person sort of doesn't come back to the same place. He gets farther and farther, and I say he because only men are stupid enough to do this sort of thing.
I love you, man. Did I ever tell you I love you, man? I'm not walking back where I was a minute ago. I'm not walking back there.
Right. No, Bill and I could tell some stories about this. But back to the history here. That's sort of a good model, I think, for sometimes our life paths and for the path that I took as a scientist, where I sort of was looking around for something really interesting. It couldn't be too far away. It had to make use of the skills and knowledge that I had, but it had to excite me. And I literally randomly leafed through the catalog at Yale University to see what other sorts of science was being done.
So let's say I'm leafing through the catalog. What's the name of the thing that attracted? What's the name of the course that attracted you?
I was looking at faculty and their descriptions of the research that they did, and I forget the name of this faculty member, but...
Oh, that's pretty convenient, doctor.
Well, it is. You know, the name of the innocent will be protected here. I did continue to leaf through the catalog, and I saw that there was a professor who I will name, Barry Saltzman, who was using math and physics to model Earth's climate, and he was in the Department of Geology and Geophysics, and so I went to talk with him. We sort of hit it off. I decided to do my summer research with him that year and stayed on to do my PhD with Barry Saltzman, modeling Earth's climate. To me, it was the biggest, most complicated physics problem one could ever hope to take on. And that's what was so appealing to me. And of course, it isn't strictly just a physics problem because there's chemistry in here, there's biology in here. And in fact, if we talk about the larger issue of climate change, well, then you're talking about policy and economics and ethics and everything else. But in the mid-1990s, I'm beginning to finish up my dissertation, my PhD research. This is exactly the time when there was a consensus emerging within the scientific community. In fact, it was the 1995 IPCC report, the second assessment report of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, 1995.
Which is part of the United Nations, right?
Which is operates under the auspices of the United Nations, absolutely, and it's literally thousands of scientists around the world assessing, you know, the literature, assessing our state of knowledge about the issue of climate change.
Right, so the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change,
IPCC,
right.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yep. And it was about that time when the IPCC first came out with the conclusion that there was now, and I'll quote it very specifically, a discernible human influence on our climate. That was the sort of key sentence in the summary for policymakers of the 1995 second IPCC report. And so this was, as I'm finishing my PhD, is when the larger scientific community is coming to a consensus that human-caused climate change, you know, is here. We can see it.
24 years ago.
Well, that's the irony, isn't it? Individual researchers had sort of sounded the alarm decades earlier. And in fact, ironically, in ExxonMobil's own internal documents, back in the 1970s, their own scientists, remember, ExxonMobil went on to fund this disinformation campaign to debunk the science of climate change because it threatens their bottom line, or continued reliance on fossil fuels. But their own scientists back in the mid-1970s, and in one of the internal documents that's now in the public domain, and this is a quote, the impacts of climate change could be catastrophic. That's ExxonMobil's own scientists in an internal document in the 1970s.
1977 is the way I recall it.
That is exactly right. But there's an important lesson here is how conservative the scientific community really is. When you talk about these assessments, be they the IPCC scientific assessments or the National Academy of Sciences assessments, they are by their nature extremely conservative because they are a scientific lowest common denominator. What all of these scientists with varying viewpoints and varying approaches can agree upon, and it tends to be a very conservative conclusion. So whereas individual scientists were determining decades earlier that we are probably seeing human caused warming. It took until the mid-1990s for the community collectively to say, yeah, that's happening.
To agree on language. And when you say conservative, you don't mean politically conservative. You mean let's not overstate this.
Yeah, reticent. Let's call it reticent. So exactly.
So along this line, I think we have Jacob on the line. We have a caller that will ask, I think, a question that ties right in here.
Great. Jacob, are you there?
Yeah, I am.
Okay, thanks, Jacob. Welcome to Science Rules. Where on earth are you calling from? I mean, not where on earth, but, you know, where on earth?
Peterborough, Ontario, Canada.
Great. How's the weather, not the climate? How's the weather there right now?
Oh, it's pretty chilly right now. We've got probably about half a foot of snow.
We all know that weather and climate are two separate things. What is your question? You have a question for Dr. Mann?
Yeah, so my question is, what are some strategies for conversing with skeptics about climate change?
Well, thanks for the question,
That's
Jacob.
A good question.
Yeah, it's a great question. And by the way, as Jacob describes the conditions up there, snowy and cold, clearly that disproves all of what we're talking about here today.
You're being ironic. Hey, everybody. Dr. Mann is being ironic.
Yeah, they can't see the flashing irony light going off right
yes.
here.
Doot, doot, doot.
Hashtag snark. And it's relevant to your question, in fact, my glib comment there, because we do hear those sorts of claims, right? A cold day in Peoria somehow discredits 200 years of basic physics and chemistry, the greenhouse effect. Of course, that's absurd, but it's an example of how we sometimes are dealing with arguments that are not entirely made in good faith. And so that's the first thing in my view. And my approach is to first determine, is this person coming to me legitimately skeptical? And remember, skepticism is a good thing in science. Our friend Carl Sagan wrote eloquently about how skepticism is the self-correcting machinery that guides science towards a better and better understanding of the natural world. It's a critical thing, but it has to be objective. And when skepticism is applied selectively, which is to say, by rejecting the overwhelming consensus of the world's scientists based on the flimsiest of arguments that don't hold up to the slightest bit of scrutiny, well, that's not skepticism, is it? It's contrarianism or outright denial.
But to Jacob's point, you confront these people all the time.
Yeah. So you got to figure out, where are they coming from? Are they legitimately skeptical? And if that's the case, if they just are misunderstanding the facts, then talking about the facts can make a difference. But more often these days, what we encounter is sort of contrarianism that is ideologically driven. It's not really about the facts. There's cognitive dissonance. They sort of know that it's real. They know that the science is there, but it threatens their ideology. You know, if they're against government regulation and they think that regulating carbon emissions or acting on climate is going to sort of threaten their sort of political principles of small government and that regulation is a bad thing, then that sort of forces them into a corner where they're sort of forced to deny the problem. Adding to that is the fact that many of their opinion leaders right now in the conservative world have adopted almost as part of the official identity of the party that climate change is a hoax. And you can't be a loyal foot soldier without sort of agreeing with that tribal belief.
Right.
So, Jacob, you must encounter these people. That's why you brought it up. Is that right?
That's right. Various times throughout my life, I've been confronted by a couple people. Definitely.
And how have those conversations gone? Have you ever walked away feeling like you actually changed somebody's mind?
Not really. That's the, I guess that's the difficult thing.
Right.
Yeah, we know that feeling. Just to sort of finish the thought that I'd begun there, or the comment. If it is about ideology, then maybe, Jacob, you're not the right person to be talking to them. If this friend of yours or family member or whoever it might be is sort of has libertarian beliefs or conservative beliefs and doesn't like regulation and thinks that this issue, that climate change is somehow a concern of the extreme environmental left, well, then maybe you might want to, make him or her aware of the fact that, actually the national security community considers climate change a major threat. They see it as a threat multiplier. There's a linkage with international terrorism. ISIS grew out of an environment that was impacted by an unprecedented drought in Syria. So talking about it in a different way, getting them to understand that, this is an issue that actually conservatives and progressives alike should care about. It's a problem for national security. It's the biggest threat to the global economy. There's no bigger threat to our economy than the already disastrous impacts that climate change is having. The unprecedented wildfires out west in California, unprecedented superstorms, the flooding of Houston and North Carolina, the perpetual inundation now of Miami Beach simply by high tides. We are seeing the damaging effects of climate change already. And sometimes helping them connect the dots and realizing it's not about saving polar bears up in the Arctic. It's not just that. I do want to sort of save, I do want to preserve the beauty and wonder of this world for my daughter and future generations. So it is about that, but it's about much more. It's about impacts, already damaging impacts on us today where we live.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. The single biggest reason to worry about the climate is us. So Jacob, I hope that helps. And thank you so much for asking that question. That really helped us get to the right place here.
Here's my problem with libertarianism.
You've got a problem with libertarianism?
Yes.
I always thought of you as like a big libertarian, Bill.
No. The problem is everybody doesn't start on the same starting line. That's sort of fundamental. I mean, if you're born poor, your life is quite different than if you're not. And pulling yourself up by your bootstraps is okay if you have certain toeholds to start with. Toeholds and bootstraps. It's all in there, Corey.
Yeah.
But that this is so obvious to me and not other people is a chin stroke. But with that said,
Science Rules will be right back.
Want to connect with a family member who doesn't speak your language? Then check out the language learning program Rosetta Stone on desktop or as an app. Rosetta Stone is designed to immerse you in the language you're learning through an intuitive process. Plus, the True Accent feature even gives you feedback on your pronunciation. And with a lifetime membership, you have access to all 25 offered languages. Get started today. Visit rosettastone.com/pod50 to get 50% off your lifetime membership now. That's rosettastone.com/pod50 for 50% off.
You're listening to Science Rules.
So, Michael, you have this book out, I guess it's out in paperback now, that the Madhouse Effect. I feel like you're kind of leading up to that. Maybe you can talk a little bit about what you mean by the madhouse effect and how we deal with it.
Oh, sure. Well, let me read you a quote about the madhouse effect. If you are not concerned about climate change yet, please read this book. If you are unaware of the hardcore deniers among us, read this book. If you are a climate change denier, doubter, techno-fixer, or lukewarmer, read this book. Mann and Tolles, that's Tom Tolles, the Washington Post cartoonist, who was my co-author, have written some words and drawn some pictures for you, so maybe you'll get it this time. That was the quote from the wonderful Bill Nye, the science guy.
A little incestuous there. That was what you call a blurb.
Or a written on the blurb. In the biz, we call it log rolling, where one person rolls a log for the next person. But for those of us out there who have not read and blurbed your book, what is the madhouse effect?
Simply put, it's the madhouse that we find ourselves in. And sometimes when I use that word, it reminds me of the great film, The Planet of the Apes.
It's Charlton Heston.
In fact, I've used that meme on occasion.
Yes.
On Twitter to sort of drive home, how crazy it is. And Bill's comment about the book speaks to that, how crazy it is that we're, it's the 21st century, the amazing technology that we have locked into our little cell phones that have more power than the most powerful computer had just a couple decades ago. The amazing things that technology has brought us, and yet we're back in the Stone Age when it comes to accepting the lessons from the scientific community. We have depended on the scientific community for all of the wonders of modern life, and yet sometimes for ideological reasons we find people rejecting the overwhelming consensus of the scientific community, and that's where we are with climate change. Now, when we wrote this book, when it was first published, that was fall 2016. It was before our last presidential election, and I could tell you, I had colleagues who were criticizing me, saying, "Why are you writing a book about climate change denialism? We're past all of that. It's now going to be all about solutions. We've gotten past the denial." Well, and then we elected Donald Trump.
Sorry,
right?
It's not funny, but it's funny.
Well, it would be funny if it weren't so sad and terrifying, because we literally have arguably right now perhaps the most powerful person in the world, the president of the United States, who is a climate change denier and an apologist for fossil fuel interests who are trying to, lead us and our policymakers and all of us astray when it comes to this, maybe the greatest challenge we face, the challenge to avert catastrophic climate change.
I'd love to go back to our callers here, because we have some very engaged callers here, and we have Emma on the line. Emma, are you there?
I sure am. Hi.
Emma, welcome to Science Rules.
Thank you.
Where are you sitting, standing, pacing right now?
Yeah, I'm in Madison, Wisconsin.
Okay. How are you thinking about the world over there? Are you concerned about climate change?
I sure am, actually. I'm a student. I'm studying public affairs. I'm a grad student. So my focus is on environmental policy. So I'm definitely worried about
this. Okay, so you're thinking about it a lot. So what is your question there?
Yeah, so climate change is such a complex issue. So what, in your opinion, is the single most important thing we can do right now to alleviate the pressures from climate change?
Well, thanks so much for the question. It's a great question. And by the way, I was going to ask, what's the weather like up there in Madison right now?
It's actually starting to warm up, so we're about 60 degrees and rainy today.
We've got two locations right now. One of them was cold, but one of them fairly warm.
Not two different latitudes.
No.
Both in North America.
No.
Yeah.
Right. So that's weather for you folks. And if you average over enough of it, over a large enough part of the Earth, you get climate. You get the average temperature of the Earth, which is steadily rising. So it's a great question. The single most important thing that I think we can do, and it's become almost a cliche, but it's true, so I'll say it anyway, is to talk about it, to make sure that this remains part of our public discourse, part of the conversations we have daily with our friends and family members and classmates and professors and what have you. That's That's important, and it's making a difference. Right now, there was a poll out of Iowa, and they were polling Democratic voters who are likely to participate in the Iowa caucus, I guess. But they were polling Democrats in sort of this fairly middle-of-the-road, Midwestern state of Iowa as to what are their main concerns, what are the greatest priorities. Economy, I think, was number one. Number two was climate change. We've never seen climate change rank that high in any sort of major polling of either party, Democrat or Republican.
Now, so, let me ask you. This is Emma. You're a young person. Yeah, you're in graduate school.
Yep.
Michael, would you say that climate contrarianism is age-related?
Oh, it is. There's a demographic that some of us here belong to, the, you know, increasingly older white male demographic. And that's overwhelmingly where it comes from, frankly, in my own experiences, which is good news because that demographic is, well, they're moving along and they're being replaced by younger folks who totally get it.
But now, Emma, I'm curious. I mean, do you have an opportunity to talk to people who are, I mean, if not skeptics, maybe, you know, people who just don't pay attention much to climate as an issue? Do you have an opportunity to talk to people, you know, friends, family? And if so, you know, have you found those conversations helpful?
Yeah, especially over social media now, you really get that opportunity quite frequently to talk with people who don't necessarily agree with your beliefs. I think it's helpful personally just because I can see what they think and kind of help shape what my rebuttal would be, right? And be able to kind of figure out what they see as the main issue and how I can like tie climate change into that issue. But it's definitely helpful to talk with people with differing views.
What do you hope to do when you get out of school?
That's a great question. I guess I would like to do communications for an environmental government organization. So my dream job would be to work at Department of Interior.
So hear that, everybody. This is Emma. You are a young person. You got your life in front of you. What she wants to do is work for the public good.
Public service.
Is that a bad thing? Is that old-fashioned?
That's great.
I don't think so.
So both of my parents were in World War II. Everybody in the whole country, everybody in the Allies and every country among the Allies was focused on winning this war. That's what everybody was doing. And they got it done in 5 years.
Yeah.
And
nobody said, "Oh, you know, we need to." I don't think the evidence is in. I think we really need to study whether Nazi tanks are really rolling across Europe.
Were those bombs in Pearl Harbor? Did that really happen?
Honestly, aren't the people who study bombs paid by the bomb industry?
And you know what else they weren't saying? They weren't saying, "Oh, you know, this is just too big of a problem.
Right?
There's just no way.
Yes.
There's just no way we can do this." That was not. It's never been our identity, our approach.
By our, you mean the United States?
Yeah, well, absolutely. You know, what's happened
and
to that can-do spirit?
Yeah,
absolutely,
no,
as well, our friends to the north.
No, but really,
what happened to that can-do spirit, right?
So we're going to bring it back, Mike. You're
right.
Going to be the guy.
Well, and Emma, thank you so much for not just for calling in, but for choosing a path of really trying to help everyone, trying to give back, which is a great place to be.
Not just give back. She'll make
absolutely.
A living, and she will affect the future and change the world. This is all good.
That's what we're trying to do here.
Michael,
you encounter a lot of haters. You interact with and absorb, I would say, a staggering amount of hate from people who for whatever reason are very, you know, anxious.
Dr. Michael Mann,
anxious
hate absorber.
Anxious or angry about climate change and what you need to do in response to it. You mentioned earlier the generational aspect. I'm wondering if some of that is a sense of, you know, an older generation resentful that their world is being displaced or replaced by younger people with different concerns, with a different agenda. Is that part of where the anger comes from?
Yeah, and just to draw an intergenerational linkage here, my philosophy when it comes to dealing with the haters is informed by the words of one Taylor Swift. You shake it off. Right. You just, you know, you develop a thick enough skin to realize, you know, it's silly, right? I mean, the commentary, some of the commentary out there on social media, online, is just silly. And it's not especially constructive to engage the haters. It's much more constructive to ignore that and focus on the overwhelming majority of the people who want to do the right thing. Many of them are confused either about the science of climate change or think it's just too hard, that we can't do it. And that's really the demographic, if you will, that I target in much of my outreach efforts, my communication, is that I ignore that fringe, very small percentage of the population whose heels are dug in. They are proactive in their denial of climate change and their attacks on the science and the scientists. They're a small, tiny, and shrinking fraction of the population. And we could expend way too much time and effort and resources trying to bring them along when they're not going to be brought along. Their heels are dug in. Let's focus on, again, the vast majority of the population who are not ideologically opposed to the idea that climate change is real, but many of them are confused about, you know, how much of a threat it really is and what they can do about it. And we can help them along.
Speaking of what we can do about it, there are a lot of people, it seems to me, who want to take a shortcut. I'm talking about our good friends in geoengineering.
Oh, yeah.
I believe you have a thought or two about geoengineering.
Is that's me or Bill?
Both of you. For those not familiar, geoengineering is the idea that humans can deliberately take sort of technological projects to affect Earth's climate, to undo some of the effects of global warming.
And not in a subtle way, right? Giant, we're going to change the climate of the whole planet. Here we go, by pushing this button.
Right. Well, you know, to give you an idea of my views on this, the chapter in The Madhouse Effect on geoengineering is entitled Geoengineering or What Could Possibly Go Wrong? And that's really the point here, right? We are manipulating, talking about the manipulation at the planetary scale, an unprecedented, uncontrolled, global scale planetary intervention with a system we don't understand perfectly. The great Wally Broker, who's a great climate scientist and who was also an important communicator to the public, he unfortunately passed away a few weeks ago. But he used to say, you know, the climate is an angry beast and we are poking it with sticks. And I think that is sort of a good, you know, way of thinking about this. All of a sudden, you know, that angry beast will turn around and attack you if you're not careful.
There's a proposal, for example, to shoot, hydrogen sulfide, some sort of sulfate.
Right. Yeah.
Yellow powder into the sky,
right,
which will reflect sunlight. And then I presume the stuff will fall back to Earth sooner or later. And then what if you start doing that and cool the Earth off? What happens if you stop doing it? And also, if you're blocking sunlight, pick a number, 1%, wouldn't that affect crops? Wouldn't that affect food production?
Absolutely. And here's the scary thing. There was an article that came out in one of our leading journals, Nature Climate Change, one of the Nature journals, by a group of scientists.
That's the Carrie Emanuel paper?
Carrie Emanuel is a co-author.
Okay,
Carrie Emanuel is a good friend and a very respected colleague. And he's a co-author on the article, I think, because of his expertise on hurricanes. And, mm-hmm. and that was one of the things that they were looking at. I'm a bit skeptical about the larger claim and messaging in the article. It basically claim that geoengineering, blocking out a certain amount of sunlight through, for example, injecting these sulfate aerosols, as Bill was describing, into the stratosphere, mimicking what a volcanic eruption does, the same way that a volcanic eruption blocks incoming sunlight and cools down the planet. And they were argued that if you did that in conjunction with a low, decreasing carbon emissions, you know, that you wouldn't see that many bad effects. Well, that was just one modeling study. They used one particular metric for evaluating the effects. And it turns out they were treating the problem as if you're simply turning down the dial on the sun. But that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about injecting chemicals into the stratosphere that are going to interact with the stratospheric chemistry and might worsen ozone depletion and might, by the way, worsen acid rain as well. And here's the real problem. If you rely on simply trying to reduce the solar heating of the planet and you allow CO2 to continue to build up, you will continue to literally acidify the ocean, dissolve the coral reefs, which are already, at the current rate, they will be gone in a matter of decades. The Great Barrier Reef is already hanging by a thread. And that problem will continue to get worse. You'll continue to acidify the ocean. And here's the thing. It's a crutch, right? Because if you start saying, well, you know what? We can simply inject more and more of these aerosols into the stratosphere to block out more and more sunlight to offset the building up of CO2 in the atmosphere. It's sort of like climate methadone, and it's a great excuse for polluters, right? It's a great excuse for polluters right. to say, oh, well, you know, we can just solve the problem this way. So let's proceed with business as usual, burning of fossil fuels. And as Bill mentioned, one of the problems, of course, is if all of a sudden you're forced to kick that addiction. Let's say we have a war that breaks out and the infrastructure for doing this geoengineering is damaged or destroyed. Then we get back in a period of a few years, all of that warming that right. had been hidden by the increase in these aerosols, these sun-blocking aerosols. And so you want to talk about rapid climate change. We would have climate change that, so rapid that there is absolutely no analog in the entire geological record.
Okay. So geoengineering is not this great cure-all. The question is, what is? So let's. I want to bring in another caller. We have David on the line. David, are you there?
I'm here. Hello.
Okay. Oh, welcome to the show. And where are you calling from?
I'm calling from Huntingdon in England.
In England. We're doing a weather census of each of our callers. What is the weather like where you're calling from?
We actually have weather warnings at the moment for storms and flooding.
Oh, dear.
It's actually pretty miserable outside right now.
Hmm.
So it's raining. Does it flood in that area often?
It does. So we're actually in quite a flat part of the country. So there is quite often some flooding. What they're predicting is much more serious flooding than you would normally get. So there's areas around here which are set aside to contain floodwaters because it's a common thing. Hmm. But those are less and less adequate.
Right. So, David, what is your question? I'm guessing that this might be somewhat related to what's on your mind.
Yes. Well, my question really is it too late to prevent really serious damage because of climate change? I mean, I just talked about the flooding we had. We actually recorded the hottest winter temperature ever in the UK, 20.8 degrees centigrade or 69.4 degrees Fahrenheit. In Porthmadog in Gwynedd in Wales, which is extremely warm for that part of the world.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, so it goes right to the heart of this question. We're already seeing unprecedented, disastrous extreme weather events. The wildfires in California, the unprecedented floods in the U.S. And Europe and Japan this last summer, unprecedented heat waves, including Europe this last summer, another near-record heat wave over a period of a couple decades that has seen, all-time records for heat all around Europe broken. And so there is this pattern of increasingly damaging extreme weather events that we know is aggravated by climate change. And the science is still, being worked out. And our own research has demonstrated that the current generation climate models that are used for many of the projections of climate change impacts don't actually resolve some of the important atmospheric processes that may describe how climate change is causing these unprecedented extreme weather events. So if anything, our model projections are probably underestimating the role that climate change is playing with these extreme weather, these very damaging extreme weather events.
Yeah. But here's the thing, Mike, and here's the thing, David. We do know that it's humans that are causing it.
Yeah.
Like, just think if this stuff was going on, if it were flooding where you are, David, these extreme events that we've had out west in North America and the floods in the southern part of the United States, just think if all that was going on and we didn't know what was causing it. That would be really troubling. So, David, you have to be optimistic. This is to say, I'm not saying we ignore what's going on. It's just that we have to be optimistic in order to solve these problems. If you go into any sort of problem with the predisposition that it cannot be solved, that you'll never get there, then you won't solve it. And you, David, as a good British citizen, recall the extraordinary effort that Britain went through to resolve World War II, especially in Europe. So we can do this, man. Right. Let's go.
By some measure, dangerous climate change has already arrived. If you're Puerto Rico, if you're California, if you're Houston, if all around the world, dangerous climate change impacts have arrived. And so it isn't a binary thing. It isn't like, we have to keep the warming below, you know, this amount or we get dangerous climate change. By some measure, we're already getting dangerous climate change. And it's simply a question of how much further down this carbon emission highway we're willing to go, because the further we go down that highway, the worse and worse it gets. What we need to do is find the nearest exit. And if we miss the 1.5 degrees Celsius exit, we still go for the 2 degrees Celsius exit. And if we miss that one, we still go for the 2.5 exit.
Stick around for more Science Rules after this.
Want to connect with a family member who doesn't speak your language? Then check out the language learning program Rosetta Stone on desktop or as an app. Rosetta Stone is designed to immerse you in the language you're learning through an intuitive process. Plus, the True Accent feature even gives you feedback on your pronunciation. And with a lifetime membership, you have access to all 25 offered languages. Get started today. Visit rosettastone.com/pod50 to get 50% off your lifetime membership now. That's rosettastone.com/pod50 for 50% off.
Science Rules is back.
I want to get to a caller, Corey, that's going to ask about a classic climate issue. Cameron, are you out there?
Hi.
Cameron, you have a question.
Hello, Cameron.
Oh, yeah. And yes. Where are you calling from, Cameron? Where are you calling from?
Actually, I'm calling from the most appropriate place, Washington, D.C.
yes.
Just let me give you the climate or the weather breakdown for us. All week it's been bouncing between 30 and 70 degrees.
Fahrenheit, between freezing and pretty warm day.
Right. This is why looking at climate as a long-term global phenomenon is really, really different than looking at, trying to gauge what's going on in the whole world from today's weather right here where you happen to be sitting.
So my colleagues and I, we've gone back and forth on this a few times trying to figure out this question. So I'm so excited that I get to ask the panel this. What's more damaging to Earth's climate, fossil fuels or cow farts?
Before you go off on cow farts, I just want to remind everybody, it's a charming thing and the conservatives love to deal with it, but it's actually cow burps.
Right.
It's actually coming out the front of the cow, not the back. It's sort of fundamental. If you're going to address a problem, it's good to know which end it's coming from. But
yeah,
with that said,
there is something telling that the people don't know which end of the cow they're dealing with. But that's a whole other issue.
So, Mike, Dr. Mann, is it a worthy thing to ask which is worse? Take it, Mike.
Yeah. So as Bill said, it's, you know, the much maligned cows are actually belching that methane. And there is a lot of misinformation out there. And they're, you know, genuinely concerned people who are well-intentioned, who have been misled by some of the bad information out there. In particular, there was a film, Cowspiracy, some years ago that falsely claimed that that the majority of our carbon emissions come from animal agriculture, from livestock, and it's just not true. It's you know, somewhere between 10 to 15% globally
which
of our
is
carbon
not nothing.
Emissions.
That's not
it's
nothing.
Not nothing, exactly. So, you know, there's no silver bullet is the bottom line. Now, 2/3 of those carbon emissions are burning fossil fuels for energy and transportation. That's the lion's share. That's what we want to, you know, obviously focus on the most. But we need to look at every sector of society because there are carbon emissions that arise from pretty much everything we do. And agriculture is part of it. And land use is part of it. And food choices are part of it. It's great if people want to make, you know, changes in their diet that are more carbon friendly. In many cases, they make us healthier. There are no regrets. We should be doing them anyways. And that's true for lots of actions that we can take. These voluntary actions are important. But ultimately, if we want to solve this problem, we need a price on carbon. And we need to get away from fossil fuels as quickly as we can.
All right. So Cameron, I think you have a nice, clear answer there. If you have to choose which is the bigger issue, fossil fuels or cow burps, start with fossil fuels. You start with the biggest slice of the pie.
Thank you.
So, Mike, I don't know if you know this sound.
Oh,
that's not
a
derecho.
Like a thunderstorm.
Well, that's because we're coming on the lightning round. So are you ready for the lightning round, Doctor?
Oh, I suppose so. Gee, okay, here we go.
I'm sitting down.
Do you drive an electric car?
Sort of.
You drive a hybrid?
Hybrid.
Why did you choose that?
Because it's carbon friendlier, and you know, I think it sets an example for others.
Plus, you get 40 miles to the gallon, for crying out loud.
I do.
It
gets better. Absolutely,
it's win-win. Do you have a favorite ocean current?
Oh, the Gulf Stream, of course.
Yeah, that's a classic.
Dr. Mann, are you a vegan?
I am not from the system, the Vega system, if that's what you're asking.
Do you eat meat?
So I do not eat meat. I'm not vegan. I have chosen to be pescatarian.
You eat fish?
I do. And each of us has to find that comfort level. And but all of us can do better. And that's my effort to get away from meat, at least.
And the
and
fish,
I keep it to fish.
The fish you eat are native to Western Pennsylvania?
Yes, we find them in the sewers, actually. These are bottom-feeding fish that I catch myself with my bare hands, and I just bite the heads off. And you're going to edit this out, right?
Okay. There's nothing better than a nice fresh fish. If I gave you a magic time machine, I said, hey, you can travel, you know, 100 or 200 years in the future and see how we've dealt with the problem or not dealt with the problem, would you want to go? Would you feel good about making that? Let's say it's a one-way trip.
Okay, and I don't get to choose my future among multiple potential futures.
You get to jump ahead and see how the world actually dealt with it. Do you think you're going to be seeing a good world if you jump ahead a century or two?
I do. I'm an eternal optimist. It's what keeps me going through some of the tougher times. I'm driven, you know, by a strong belief that, you know, when confronted with massive challenges, we've risen to the occasion in the past. We talked about some of those examples. We will do it here. And part of why we'll do it here is, of course, you guys getting that message out to the public, making a real difference, and these kids making a real difference. I think we are seeing action. I think we're seeing a turning point in the nick of time. Literally in the nick of time.
Right on, Dr. Mann. Let's get out there. Thank you so much for taking the time. Let's get out there, everyone, and dare I say it, change the world. Thank you so much, Dr. Michael Mann from Penn State, for being our guest today.
Thank you, guys. It was a total pleasure.
It was great having you here, and thank you, Bill.
Oh, thank you, Corey.
Oh, yes.
I'm Bill Nye.
I am Corey S. Powell.
And remember, when it comes to the climatological part of our universe, science rules. So listeners, if you have questions, and I hope you do, if this episode just seemed just too short and you want to get your question in, call us and leave a message and we will do our best to answer it. Call 201-472-0785. If you like Science Rules, I hope you do, please take a moment to rate and review it in Apple Podcasts and on Stitcher. It helps us out, helps us understand who's listening, and helps us improve the show, and it helps people like you learn about the show so they too can listen. Thank you. Science Rules is produced by Jordan Bell. Our engineer is Jared O'Connell. Mixing and original theme music were by Casey Halford. Special thanks to Claire Rawlinson. Chris Bannon is the Chief Content Officer of Stitcher. And at Stitcher, Science Rules.
Stitcher.